Betsy and Joe Piet, welcome to COVID Race and Democracy. Could you please introduce yourselves and tell us how you are connected to Mumia?
Thank you, Ken. I have been following Mumia's case both as an activist here in Philadelphia since 1995 and throughout that time as a journalist for Workers' World newspaper writing on the case. I'm currently one of the managing editors of the newspaper. I was able to sit through almost all of the recent court hearings in his current appeal.
And I'm Joe Piet. I've also been active in the movement on the streets for Mumia since the mid-90s. I've worked with PAM Africa for decades with the International Concerned Family and Friend of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and in the last 5 or so years with Mobilization for Mumia.
All right, thank you for that. And organizationally, how would you like to be identified on our website?
As a managing editor of Workers' World Newspaper.
And a member of Mobilization for Mumia. I forgot to say I'm a photographer too, so I got a couple decades of photos of Mumia activities.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. Mumia has maintained his innocence since he was arrested in 1981, and he has filed a lot of legal challenges since then. Can you give us a brief summary of the main legal issues Mumia has raised in the past, and then focus in on what's happening now with his legal case?
Mumia's issues from the beginning have focused on police corruption and misconduct, on a poor representation with his initial public defender, and on judicial and prosecutorial misconduct, including his attorney and being denied evidence in the case, his representation initially being inadequate, the police who were on the scene did the initial investigation of his case. Of the 30 officers, 15 of them were subsequently dismissed for corruption. And there are issues regarding racism in the jury selection, witnesses who were coerced to change their testimony. The list goes on. Every time Mumia's case has come before various courts for appeals, often on based on a ruling in another case before his that one would think would be favorable to him, the judicial system has ruled against him, and then only to reverse itself in the next case that comes along on the same issues. This has happened so often that journalist Lynn Washington Jr. here in Philadelphia has coined the phrase the Mumia exception. And, you know, we're seeing that again with the current situation with Philadelphia's so-called progressive district attorney, Larry Krasner, who, since he's been in office, his office has exonerated, at this point, 20 other individuals with cases very similar to Mumia's. You could tick all the boxes, and they would come out the same. And yet, in Mumia's case, he refuses to even investigate, have his office even investigate those charges that have been raised by Mumia.
So what do you believe is behind that? I mean, you're saying he campaigned as a progressive reform-oriented DA. He's ended the wrongful incarcerations of close to 20 people. So why is he fighting so hard to keep Mumia in prison?
I think one has to be in Philadelphia long enough to see the power of the Fraternal Order of Police here, who make and break political careers. Most of the judges on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court are there because they had the backing of the Philadelphia Fraternal Order of Police. This is true also for most DAs. I would suspect that Larry Krasner hopes to use his career as district attorney to launch, you know, an additional political career. It's very hard to do on a statewide level without that FOP backing. There's a lot of political connections to this case. Most of the individuals involved in it, from Ed Rendell when he was district attorney, who then went on to become mayor, who then went on to become the governor of Pennsylvania, and somewhere in between the head of the Democratic National Organization for a time, Lynn Abraham, another one of the prosecutors involved, had a higher political career. There's more that I can think of, and I forget. Ron Castile is a good example, who was, you know, initially the district attorney at the time of Mumia's appeals, and then went on to have a career on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court from, I think, 1999 to 2014, and is the last part of that career as the highest judge on that court. And he was very much involved in terms of being a proponent of the death penalty, and also a darling, another darling of the Fraternal Order of Police. So there's a lot of those connections. And I think, you know, Krasner's intentions may have been good, but he is beginning to sound more and more like his predecessors on this case.
Tell us some more. I mean, you said there's just been a sort of endless list of different legal issues that have been raised and re-raised. What currently are the main issues? What's pending now, and what have the current issues been?
The current case that is active right now stems from a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that was issued in, I want to say, August of 2016, and it was the decision Williams versus Pennsylvania. And it involved Ron Castile, who, again, was the district attorney when the Williams case was heard in Philadelphia, and then later went on to become the Pennsylvania Supreme Court Justice when that case came before that court. In a similar way to Mumia's, Castile refused to recuse himself when the case came before him. And it was interesting. What is his claim that why should he recuse himself when, you know, several of the other justices on the court also received money from the Fraternal Order of Police? He actually said that at the time, you know, I think in the late 1990s, or early, whenever it first came up that he should recuse himself. So I'm losing track of thought here.
That's okay. I was just asking you what the current issues were. So you're saying Ron Castile was one.
The current issue that this case started with was the issue of judicial bias on Ron Castile's part. That it's an issue when it finally was ruled by Common Pleas Court Judge Leon Tucker in December rather of 2018. It involved a judge, you know, that a reasonable observer could conclude that a judge harbored disqualifying bias against the petitioner, against the person seeking an appeal, and this was the case with Williams, and it clearly has been the case with Mumia. The legal hearings themselves started on April 24th, 2017, and they were held here in Philadelphia, those hearings. They went on all of that year, 2017. In November 2017, Krasner was elected district attorney. His predecessor, Seth Williams, had been kicked out of office for corruption and was actually serving time in jail at the time. Krasner took over in January of 2018 and came into the court. He actually didn't come in. His prosecutors each time would dispute that the Williams versus Pennsylvania applied in Mumia's case. But throughout the process, they had to produce boxes of files. And I think by the time it was done, they probably had somewhere near 300 boxes of files on the case. And there was a discovery that happened in 2018 of, and I want to go to my notes here, bear with me. It surfaced, two pieces of evidence came to light in the process of searching through these hundreds of boxes of files, looking for anything linking Castile directly to the case. And there was a letter from Castile in June 1990 to then Governor Robert P. Casey, and it was requesting that Casey fast-forwards some of the death penalty cases that were before him, specifically cases in which involved the death of a police officer. And Mumia's case at the time, even though it hadn't reached the process where a death warrant could be issued, it was one of three cases that was in the appellate process at that time. And while Mumia's name was not specifically mentioned in that letter, it clearly covered a group of cases that applied to him. There was a subsequent piece of evidence that was filed, which was, again, from Castile to then State Senator Michael Fisher, who was also promoting legislation to further restrict state appeals of death penalty convictions. And Castile wrote to say he supported that. And in that letter, Mumia's case was one of nine capital defendants who was cited in that request to Fisher to proceed with that legislation. Those two pieces of evidence became the basis that Judge Tucker allowed Mumia's attorneys, Judith Ritter and Sam Spital from the Legal Defense Fund of the NAACP, he allowed them to amend their initial petition to include those two examples on linking Castile and demonstrating Castile's bias when it came to death penalty cases, and particularly to death penalty cases involving the murder of a police officer.
And wasn't there also discovered in those boxes something about a witness asking for payment? Wasn't that also an issue?
Actually, that was not in the 300-plus boxes that came before Judge Tucker. Judge Tucker made his ruling on Mumia's case toward the end of December 2018, and both parties had concluded their evidence that they were going to enter, and the ruling came out in favor of Mumia having an appeal. Right after that ruling, Larry Krasner, claiming that he was searching, a couple days literally, after that ruling, claiming that he was searching for furniture in the district attorney's building, claimed to have stumbled upon six boxes of evidence in a storage area, hard to get to storage area, that had Mumia's name on them. They were numbered, I think in this case, they weren't even sequential, but they were like 20 of 29, 23 of 29, clearly indicating that there could be more of them. But these six boxes, Krasner did bring to light, brought them to Leon Tucker's attention. And Leon Tucker allowed Mumia's attorneys to review them. Within those six boxes were pieces of evidence, including a letter written by the state's primary witness, Robert Chaubert, who was a taxi driver who claimed to have been on hand at the scene, asking, "Where's my money?" There was another piece of evidence that the prosecutor during jury selection had indicated the race of jurors on a piece of paper with the list of jurors, which is a violation of the Batson case, cases involving racial bias during jury selection. There was other pieces of evidence that raised the credibility of a witness in this case, Cynthia Williams, who was one of the state's witnesses who claimed to have seen Mumia shoot Faulkner. And there are other witnesses who dispute whether Williams was even there. Williams at the time had been under arrest on another state, was on probation. The prosecutors in the case negotiated with the other state where she was being held, basically to make sure that she didn't get released before the hearings. I think out of concern that she wouldn't stay, that she was being pressured to testify. And I don't remember the final piece. There's another piece in there. But all of these things were brought by Mumia's attorneys when they filed their four appellate briefs in September of 2019. And at the time, they also asked for the case to be remanded, to be sent back to the Common Pleas Court, based on this new evidence that was uncovered in these boxes. They also had ample case history from Mumia's previous appeals that were part of the four appeals that they were raising. The issue of inadequacy of counsel was one of those appeals. I think the question of the witness's believability. Chaubert was who was driving a cab was also driving with a suspended license and had been serving on probation for attempting to firebomb a daycare center. And none of this was brought to Mumia's attention during the initial trials. All of this surfaced after the ruling, finding him guilty in July of 1982.
So all of these boxes, these six boxes, presumably were never seen at any point by anyone on Mumia's defense team, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so... thank you for all of that detail. Now, just to summarize, what is the current status right now? What is still pending, if anything, and when will that be addressed legally?
The appeal that began in April of 2017 that was ruled in Mumia's favor by Judge Tucker in 2018 is what's pending right now. The Mumia's attorneys had requested with the, I believe, Superior Court, the state Superior Court, for these four appeals to be heard, as well as for the case to be sent back to the Common Pleas Court for a hearing based on the uncovered evidence. That was filed in September of 2019. Larry Krasner, as the district attorney for the Commonwealth, was due to respond to that. He initially said, verbally at least, that he would not have an issue with the case going back to Common Pleas for hearing. He then went on to delay and delay and delay and kept asking for additional continuations on the case. And this went on through most of, let me back up my dates a little bit here, get them right. This went on from September through February of 2020. At the end of February 2020, he was due to finally file his response. Right before he had the opportunity to file his response, Maureen Faulkner, who is the widow of the police officer that Mumia was accused of killing, who works very closely with the Fraternal Order of Police, had a King's Bench petition accepted by the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court. And asking to be party to the case and asking that D.A. Krasner be removed and that the venue be given to Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro, who tends to be much more favorable to the Fraternal Order of Police. Faulkner had initially filed a similar request with the local courts in the fall of 2019. It was turned down. And then in late February of 2020, the state Supreme Court accepted her petition. Very rare petition, historically, has never been accepted when it comes to requesting a change in venue to be able to seek a more favorable outcome through the prosecutor. The court then went on to have an investigation of her claim that extended through sometime in August of 2020, and then finally in December of 2020, came out with their ruling against her petition. On February 3rd, D.A. Krasner finally filed his response to Mumia's initial appeals in this whole current process. And then on March 17th, Mumia's attorneys responded to what Krasner had written. On the same day that they did that, Faulkner again requested to have to be heard as part of this case. So that's kind of where things stand right now.
Okay, thank you. So let me ask you, you both, I understand you've both spent significant time in the court listening to these proceedings. I wonder if you can just tell listeners what that experience is like. What does it feel like to be in the courtroom during these legal proceedings?
Not like I would want to go out and get a law degree. You know, they're very legalistic. And what I tried to do throughout this process is to really try to, you know, break down what it was they were talking about. You know, we had a lot of people who were in the courtroom, some with legal backgrounds, who would then try to explain what was going on. What struck us, I think, early on was how much the current members of D.A. Krasner's team sounded like the previous members of other district attorneys who were very favorable to the paternal order police. They repeatedly claimed there was no evidence. At one point, in the initial hearings in this case, before Krasner's office got involved, the attorney of the prosecutor for the state was, let me find it here in my notes. What is his name?
You don't need it.
Anyway, the initial representative of the Commonwealth had been a prodigy of Ron Castile's. And at one point early in the hearings, where there was a question of evidence, of justice, really a question of justice for Mumia, he made the comment something to the extent of, you know, well, there could be too much justice. You know, if we let all of this be brought to light in a case, you know, it just could be too much. And he was actually asked by Judge Tucker, you know, what does it look like to have too much justice? And he said, well, you could have Mumia's case, if it was found in his favor, had the potential to open up thousands of other cases with similar situations. That's what they were afraid of. And early on, when Larry Krasner, in his most recent role, you know, defending the Commonwealth, initially when Judge Tucker ruled in Mumia's favor, made a comment very similar. You know, that if I rule, you know, if I allow this to proceed, it will open up a floodgate of similar cases. And that really seemed to be, you know, what they were most concerned about. Toward the end of the proceedings, Mumia was never let into the hearings, by the way, but toward the end of the proceedings, we would usually, you know, make sure that Mumia supporters were there. In the last two or three hearings, the court would set aside space for members of the Fraternal Order of Police and for some of the players in the initial case against Mumia to have space there. Maureen Faulkner attended the last hearing that I recall. And when Judge Tucker actually seemed to indicate that he would be, you know, taking this case for a review and did not seem to be arguing against it, Maureen Faulkner actually got up and had a tantrum in the court and was thrown out. And I think what was really important, though, not only what was going on in the case, but what was going on outside of the courtroom, which I know Joe was at and probably can add a lot more to than I can.
Well, each court appearance, we've always had lots of people outside. And some of the people would go into court, but the courtrooms are small. So we would have hundreds of people outside. You know, maybe a dozen or two would be able to get in, and we would continue the protest outside until the end of the hearings when people would come down and report what happened in court. I just want to make it clear here that a lot of the evidence has never seen the light of day in the courtroom. You know, there's much of the evidence that Betsy has brought forth earlier. There's more. There was a court stenographer who reported to Mumia's attorneys, not during the court, not during the original trial, but later, after the court proceedings were all done, that she had heard Judge Sabo. He was the judge during the original trial. And he also was the judge who ruled against Mumia's appeals, the same judge. But she had heard him say during the original trial, "I'm going to help them fry the N-word," quote unquote. She's made that in an official affidavit that that's what she heard. So the judge himself, Judge Sabo, was a hanging judge. He had convicted more people to death row than any other judge in the country. And the overwhelming majority of them, black and people of color. I'm raising issues that were never raised in court. In addition to the information in the boxes, there's more information besides the stenographer's affidavit. There's also the issue of the police story, which is that Mumia, when Officer Faulkner was on the ground, Mumia took with his pistol, shot several times, and eventually one of those bullets hit the officer in the head, meaning that many of those shots missed and hit the sidewalk underneath the underneath Faulkner. So coincidentally, there was a photographer whose name was Polikoff, and who was taking photos, and the police had not set up a perimeter, and Polikoff was able to walk wherever he wanted and took photos. He took a photo of police holding the two guns, both Faulkner's and Mumia's, with his bare hands, a violation of procedure. But he also took photos of the area where the shootings took place. First of all, the defense attorney didn't know about those photos, but Polikoff offered the photos to the police, who I believe said they didn't want to use them. So Polikoff for years had these photos. And a few years back, 10 years ago, mm-hmm. Polikoff notified the defense attorneys that he had these photos, if they might be useful to us. So we took a look at those photos, and there is no evidence of any divots in the sidewalk. There's no, it doesn't back up the police story. In order to prove it, the defense created the same conditions. They shot into a sidewalk from like 6 feet away, trying to recreate the police story. And when they shot with the same gun, same caliber gun, into a sidewalk, it always created these very visible marks in the sidewalk, divots. However, none of those divots are in any of the photos of the scene. So these Polikoff photos are very important to Mumia's defense. That's never been in court before. And there's a number of similar evidence that could prove that the police narrative of what happened on that day is incorrect, that there are witnesses that said, we saw the shooter leave the scene, run down the street. That none of that was ever brought up in court.
One of the photos, and this was taken right after the shooting, because Polikoff was a freelance journalist and a freelance photographer who, made a living from, when you hear the police radio, you go to the scene, you run to the scene. And his photos clearly show no sign of Chauvert's cab anywhere near the scene. And they do show a police car there that was Faulkner's. And the point that's been made by, Mumia's supporters is that, Chauvert is on probation, driving with a suspended license. Would he have parked his cab right behind a police car? And the odds of him doing that are slim to none. And the photos show that there was no cab there.
In the testimony that Chauvert gave, he said he had parked
right behind the cab. The other piece of evidence, and I'll do this quick, that was Mumia was never told about, his attorneys were never told about, is that there was a license that was a driver's license for Kenneth Freeman was found in Officer Faulkner's pocket. Kenneth Freeman is who many of people think may have been the person seen fleeing the scene. He was there with William Cook, who's Mumia's brother. This came out that the driver's license was there. This came out in William Cook's trial that took place separate from Mumia's. So You know, there's things here that just don't add up, and yet they've been hidden. They've been hidden, you know, from the defense and from trial, and without another hearing, that would an evidentiary hearing is what they're really seeking. These things will remain hidden, even though they're out in plain daylight.
And the reason, just to clarify, because this is a lot of very compelling evidence, the reason it's never been heard is because it was discovered quite a while after the trial. And so then when they tried to introduce it, they weren't allowed to introduce it. Is that what happened? It didn't come up at the time, in other words.
Right, right.
And the appeals have always been rejected.
Okay.
There was a witness, Pamela Jenkins, in the one of the post-conviction appeals hearings before Judge Albert Szabo in the 1990s, she was a prostitute. She had been a friend of Cynthia Williams. She wanted to testify that she had been pressured by the police to falsely identify Mumia in a hearing, and she refused to do so. In the hearing, in the appeals hearing where she testified, Albert Szabo basically, you know, had her arrested. So there was this intimidation factor that was strong throughout the case, where any of the witnesses who could potentially testify on Mumia's behalf were basically intimidated into not doing so. One of the other witnesses who was on the scene at the time, who disputed what the prosecutor's witnesses said, was basically his business was threatened. He was an eyewitness for the defense, was basically threatened, you know, to we'll send you out of business. You know, your business will be forced to shut down if you testify. But without a hearing, again, without an evidentiary hearing, post-conviction evidentiary hearing, all of this remains in boxes and none of this will come before a judge. And the state has been adamant in making sure that that doesn't happen.
All right, let me ask you one final question here. Stepping out of the legal, I mean, you've presented a lot of, at minimum, very, very serious legal questions, which the state is not allowing to even be heard. What's in the big picture politically? Why do you think this is the case? I mean, you talked about the power of the police unions in terms of the pressure on Krasner, but let's go even broader. What is it that Mumia represents that would explain the way the stance the state has taken throughout all of these decades, despite all of this evidence?
Yes. Mumia was a member of the Black Panther Party. He joined when he was 14 years old. He was very young. He was put in the COINTELPRO list of people that the FBI was watching. They had him marked as a dangerous person, you know, when he was still a teenager. So he's one of the many Black Panther Party members that have been, of course, some were killed, like in Chicago,
Fred Hampton,
that there was just a movie of. Many others were put in prison for life. Mumia was given the death penalty. Others were given decades and decades in prison. Many are still in prison. Rochelle McGee, there's a list of them, I think 26, if my memory is right. Mumia is one of them. Mumia was the only one given the death penalty. Now, the people, through many decades of work, in 2014, he was finally of 2011, he was finally released from death row. So that's, of course, that's something that that's a huge political reason that the Black Panthers, the struggle against the oppression of Black people and all that is something, of course, that the FOP, the you know, the conservatives throughout the U.S., like Black Panther to them is like a, you know, of course someone is bad if someone's a Black Panther. We see the opposite, that the Black Panthers serve food to the community. They you know, fought against police repression. That, you know, the Black Panthers were something that to this day are seen as a very credible Black organization that fought for liberation.
Mamiya was also doing work as a journalist for WHYY, National Public Radio. He was also on community radio WDAS. He was a prolific writer and a very strong voice. You know, you ask anyone who was around at that time if they hear Mamiya's voice on a tape, they'll recall remembering his voice. And he was very outspoken as a journalist during the time when a former Philadelphia police commissioner, Frank Rizzo, you know, had raided the office of the Black Panthers in Philadelphia. At the time when Rizzo became mayor and was carrying out a major attack campaign on the MOVE organization. And Mamiya was one of the journalists who would cover that case. He was an award-winning journalist. He was president of the National Association of Black Journalists. And, you know, he came to earn the title Voice of the Voiceless as a result of his contributions. And, you know, we feel that they, you know, they knew who he was. The police knew who he was at the time of his arrest in December 9, 1981. And once they found out who they had, they did not make any further effort to find the real killer of Officer Faulkner. Even though witnesses, you know, testified to seeing a man run from the scene. Mamiya was wearing clothing that did not bear any resemblance to what those witnesses described as far as the person they saw shoot Faulkner. And you know, we feel that once the state found that they had him in their hands, they're not going to let go. You know, they don't want it to come to light how much this case was contrived, how much this case has been built on decades of manipulated evidence and testimony. They will not say to this day, you know, they will not talk about the officers who were brought up on corruption charges, you know, through a federal investigation with the same officers who let the crime scene be totally accessible to people to walk around at it. You know, I had mentioned Lynn Washington Jr. earlier, and he also was a reporter at the time. And he said, I arrived on the scene and there was no yellow tape. There was nothing to stop people from tampering with any evidence that was still on the scene. And so it became kind of clear that they didn't care. The police didn't care, you know, who the real killer of Faulkner was. They had the person they wanted. They wanted to silence, and they've tried to do so ever since. And they continue today, you know, through medical neglect in the prison system. He's come close to dying, you know, twice in the last 4 years from misdiagnosed and untreated serious disease, hepatitis C, recently congestive heart disease. You know, and this is something where the fight is all about. You know, we want to see him released, and we want to see him released now.
And we want all ill and elderly prisoners released from prison. That people are dying in prison needlessly.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. What sources would you suggest for people who want to stay informed about the legal developments or who want to get involved in supporting Mumia's freedom?
I'm going to do a plug right off the bat for the mobilizationformumia.com webpage. This was set up around the time of his current appeal in 2017 to be able to serve as kind of a catch-all source for the history of the case, as well as all of the current developments, you know, whether it be protests or articles that are written. Recently, a publication called the Jamal Journal was reissued. The Jamal Journal, probably about over a decade ago, had been a regular quarterly publication in the 90s. I'm sorry, a regular publication that was put out with information on his case that was distributed in the community. Activists have reinvigorated that campaign and just released the first issue of the journal. It's in the newspaper format as well as online just about a month ago. There are other websites, you know,
Campaign to Bring Mumia Home
is one. The New York Free Mumia Coalition, I don't have the exact address on that.
Freemumia.com.
Writers like Lynn Washington Jr., who was also a professor at Temple University. I'll do a plug for workers.org, for my newspaper, you know, which when I've had to speak on this case, I just go back and look for all the articles that we've written over the years. There are some excellent documentaries on this case. Professor Johanna Fernandez produced a documentary, Justice on Trial. This came out, I believe, in 2015. But it's within the last 10 years on the case. And there's others. There's other books. Just on who Mumia is, there's a film called Long Distance Revolutionary that was a full-length professional film done by Stephen Vittoria. But on the website,
I imprisoned
my whole life. Mumia also has written 12 books. While he's been in prison, which are not so much dealing with his case, but dealing with issues of police brutality. He has a recent book, Have Black Lives Ever Mattered? He's just finished the third volume of a long series on U.S. imperialism called Murder Incorporated. And Joe mentioned the film also, In Prison My Whole Life, which is another documentary on Mumia. I'd encourage people, even though I know it's controversial, to watch the Judas and the Black Messiah film on Fred Hampton's murder, because it's very pertinent to the period in which all of this took place, you know, and what brought Mumia out as a target of the police and why. Trying to think of other things, but many of these sources are listed on the mobilizationformumia.com website. We wanted to centralize things so that they would be easy to find.
Yeah, there's a list of all the different films on this case.
Great, that's perfect.
I also want to give a plug out, and this will probably get cut, but just that this case has not been fought just here in Philadelphia or even in the U.S. This is a case that has garnered international attention. It's been raised with U.N. commissions on human rights abuse. There have been recently in our campaigns to really bring world attention to the health crisis that Mumia currently faces, particularly in the middle of COVID-19. And he did come down with COVID-19, as have many Pennsylvania prisoners. But there's been a letter writing campaign on his behalf that has included letters from all over the globe, you know, just about from every continent, of groups, labor unions, women's groups, coming out, you know, in his support. And the final thing before I forget is Amnesty International also put out their own piece of investigation on this case a number of years ago, basically coming to the conclusions that I laid out at the beginning, that there are so many questions in this case that to not reopen it is a travesty of justice.
All right. Thank you for just such a comprehensive and thorough summary of the legal issues and the political context, and for your dedicated work over all these decades. We really appreciate it.